I think it's one of those things where
I've seen a dog have diarrhea before.
Yeah, so in response to your question, did I watch the Tuesday night presidential debates? My answer is, I've seen a dog have diarrhea before. It's not something that I care to watch again.
I love that. Okay, that's my new phrase. I'm borrowing it.
It is a weird and heavy cultural moment that we occupy. And I was thinking this morning, just the ways that we are... a lot is being asked of us as people. I remember I was watching I read something online. I think it was a subreddit, like, I don't know if it was like unpopular opinions or just like, you know, there's this subreddit called True Off My Chest where people just say like they want to get something off their chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, I'm so tired of all the things I have to care about.
Yes.
And that feels more and more acute. Like the, you know, you could be forgiven for most of this year or the year before if, like, the political process was something that you weren't paying attention to.
Right.
That's harder to be forgiven for now.
Yeah.
In our current context as the election approaches. And so just one more thing to kind of add to the pile for people that we're trying to be more discerning about what was on their pile at any given time. But how are you doing?
It's so true. I feel that heaviness. You're right. That sums it up, that we do have so many things we need to care about and feel like we need to be helping with. And if you're not, then, you know, you're not doing enough. There is that societal, I think, pressure in social media right now too, that if you're not paying attention, it's like you're allowing the problem to continue, and neutrality isn't an option anymore. And I think that leads right into our talk today on agreeableness, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea, I think an agreeable person on the personality traits wants social harmony. Is that right?
Yeah. Warm, friendly, optimistic view of other people is essentially a not going to rock the boat kind of person.
And kind of sees the best in people or sees the
optimistic. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's probably hard to be that kind of a person right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And, you know, I see this in my faith conversations too, of like, you know, what should I hope for? How far will this go before we start to see improvement? And so I think the optimist in many of us is starting to say, wow, it's a long road. And a lot of things need to be cleaned up and changed. And it's very overwhelming. And, you know, to think that somebody's got it under control, I think went out the window.
Sure.
You know, we kind of feel like, does anybody have anything under control anymore? This idea of hope and optimism is a challenge. And yet I still do have it. I still hold on to hope that we are learning and growing from this horrible reverberation we are in before the breakthrough. I have to believe that that's happening. And that good things will come from this tumultuous time. But I will say sometimes hour to hour, I begin to wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is interesting because, again, I think if we look to the, we've talked about these personality traits in terms of what is most sort of pro-social or socially favorable. I think it would be easy to say, oh, well, agreeableness is better than, you know, disagreeableness. And that, I think, has been challenged of late, I think, in a way that is hard to effectively reckon with. And this is, you know, what's interesting is that I feel that this discussion is pulling us toward more broad social considerations rather than some of the more like dyadic relational types of questions that we sometimes cover. You know, so I'm thinking about the dynamic of political correctness and why that exists as something that people experience to be frustrating. And then where agreeableness, you know, shows up in that and kind of thinking about that as a way to sort of highlight what this looks like. So, you know, I think that I was, I'm trying to think when I first heard the term political correctness. Mm-hmm. I was probably in fifth grade. Mm-hmm. Can you remember that phrase,
no.
like existing and then not, or not existing and then existing?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe, yeah, maybe like high school political science or something. I don't know.
Sure.
It seemed like all of a sudden things were right or wrong to say or not say.
Right. Yeah. And I think that it was, so if you're interested in a broader discussion on things like public relations, Edward Bernays is kind of seen as like one of the pioneers of that. And Stuff You Should Know does a tremendous, probably one of their best podcasts in terms of like seeing the some of the rhythms that undergird society as we know it, and how public relations and Edward Bernays like really drove a lot of that. But certainly that existed prior to the advent of, you know, political correctness and that idea as a culture. And, but I think that what I have started to see more and more is a rejection of the idea that people should have to pay attention to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately I think the political correctness as a movement, obviously the word political seems to be derived from this idea that like, well, politicians speak this way because they don't want to make anybody mad. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's an inclination toward agreeableness. Politicians want to be seen as agreeable, generally speaking. Generally speaking, there are some politicians who don't care whether or not they're perceived as agreeable. But that speaking in a certain way really conveyed that sense of agreeableness. And then if you were seen as like, you know, being politically incorrect, then you were disagreeable. There was a, I don't care what other people think. I'm gonna say, quote unquote, say what I'm thinking and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw something the other day that I think really helped sum up what I think what we're actually talking about when we're talking about these issues. And it was somebody saying that when somebody says to you, I am not going to be muzzled or made to be politically correct in the way that I speak, what they're actually saying is, I am comfortable treating you with disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the end of the day, like
mm-hmm.
I am going to treat you in a way that will allow you to feel like you being disrespected is an acceptable cost for me not having to pay attention
wow.
to how I communicate.
Ugh.
I mean, that feels like if we're going to be super honest
yeah.
about it, that's
yeah.
what it boils down to.
Yeah.
You know, we've existed in a country and a society that for a long time, people have been able to say kind of whatever they wanted to say, especially and I say people, what I mean is like people of privilege
mm-hmm.
have basically been able to say whatever that they wanted to say. And, you know, if they were challenged on it, it never really had much teeth to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as the internet became a reality and the democratization of ideas started to, you know, become more of a reality, I think that people were able to say, oh, like, you know, we actually don't like being talked to that way or being, you know, characterized in these terms or understood with this kind of conceptualization. And then all of a sudden, an entire broad category of people who have been able to enjoy basically, you know, unrestricted speech for, you know, all of time,
mm-hmm.
where basically said, oh, maybe say things differently.
Yeah.
And I can totally understand how when you say one thing one way your whole life, and then you're suddenly said, oh, that actually hurts people
right.
when you say that. How there's this sort of immediate, like, well, I want to be agreeable.
Right.
I don't want to distress. So there's a sacrifice being made. And when people say, I'm going to start, you know, saying this because I want to be agreeable in
mm-hmm.
in the eyes of other people. And then you have this sort of counter-cultural movement, this sort of... I don't know which philosopher, was it Hegel or who was the one that basically said you've got your thesis and then you have your antithesis and then you have your synthesis.
I should know this. I don't know.
So
it might be Hegel.
Yeah, so political correctness rose up as a reality of saying like, hey, like, let's be careful about the things that we say because those matter to how people
mm-hmm.
receive the world. And then I think what we're seeing now is the antithesis of that,
mm-hmm.
the opposite side of saying, like, no, this has gone too far and our freedom of speech is being violated and those
mm-hmm.
types of things. And so then what we're left with is a, you know, are people just absolutely disregarding being respectful right. toward one another in a way that is, I think, really hurting people and mm-hmm. leading to some really destructive and problematic ideologies. And I think you mentioned this sort of, you know, long view positivity mm-hmm. of a synthesis where we get to mm-hmm. a place where we can say, okay, how can we allow ourselves to quiet our ego enough mm-hmm. that we don't take offense to everything, mm-hmm. that we can sort of see past, you know, the boomer who just doesn't have another word for what they're trying to say mm-hmm. and isn't actually being someone that's trying to hurt somebody mm-hmm. and use that as an opportunity for education versus anybody who says anything that sort mm-hmm. of goes against my preferences is somebody that I can villainize.
Yeah.
Which I think that exists too, as mm-hmm. you know, sort of part of that thesis taken to its sort of logical conclusion without mm-hmm. any intervention from the antithesis. So this has got into a little bit more moral philosophy than I really intended it to. But I think that that's part of what we see is agreeableness is this yeah. spectrum between how much am I willing to accommodate other people's experiences mm-hmm. in the shaping of my own behavior? Mm-hmm. Am I willing to say, I'm going to act a certain way so that you can be comfortable? Versus saying, like, I could care less how comfortable you mm-hmm. are, I'm going to act exactly this way. Mm-hmm. Now, the agreeable people are those are the people you love to spend time yes, with. Generally exactly. speaking, they're wonderful and terrific and yes. everything. And likely there are some people who are too agreeable.
Yes.
And you know, don't have good boundaries and make a lot of sacrifices that end up hurting them. You know, and then the people that are really disagreeable, I will go so far as to say are not like unilaterally or unequivocally bad people. There are some bad people who are disagreeable, but there are some really, really good people who are disagreeable. Mm-hmm. I think about, and I'm not, I don't know, I'm of the opinion these days that every human being is complicated. So like yes. Mother Teresa, for example, my sense of having learned about her is that she is a very disagreeable person, but she was also a pretty terrific person in terms mm-hmm. of the way that she actually engaged with the world, but wasn't like a kick to be around, you know, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And I think that history gives us a lot of examples that sort of exist on that. So that is a overextended intro into what we're talking about. How does this show up in relationships?
It's cool. So, I think so. For relationships, what's interesting, like for Rob and I personally, I would say we're both on the agreeable end of the spectrum more. Neither one of us love competition or mm-hmm. Conflict. We both love harmony. We, you know, will oftentimes have a view of the world that is just, can't everyone just get along? Can't we just mm-hmm. all be good human beings and do the right thing? And why is this so hard? You know, those are often probably sure. the flavor of our discussions. So I think that we both tend to be at that end of the spectrum, and we're both pretty optimistic people. Rob truly sees the good in everyone. And it's interesting when I, you know, have theological discussions with like somebody who grew up in a Baptist faith. Mm. They very much have this deep belief that everybody is born sinful and broken, and then we spend our lives trying to be better. And I have a belief of we are born pure love and, you know, full of potential, and society kind of conditions us, or we start to lose that belief mm-hmm. in ourselves. So you come at that, you know, when I talk to somebody who comes from a broken, sinful viewpoint versus a potential and love and you know, just remembering who we are is kind of our greatest work. Those are very different trajectories in life. And you know, I have this specific friend who thinks it's a slippery slope if I think everybody is loving. She thinks it's very safer to assume everybody is broken and sinful and evil and doing their best to not live into that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're fascinating conversations, though, because to me, it really shapes the way we see the world. It shapes the way we enter into relationships. It shapes the theology and the conversations we have with God. And so I guess when I think about this agreeableness as a personality trait and a tool with which to evaluate, I really see how, you know, this is something we all need to be cognizant of and aware of where am I on this? And, you know, I remember working for a woman early in my career that was incredibly combative. She was very competitive. She was very critical of people. She just lived that way. Mm-hmm. And I had to really work at not taking it personally. Mm-hmm. I had to really kind of learn, oh, she doesn't hate me. She just kind of assumes the worst of everybody. Sure. And, you know, that was one of my first experiences of working closely with somebody that was very different on that agreeableness spectrum. Because at first I was like, why am I not pleasing her? Why is she not happy when she's with, what am I doing wrong? And that was kind of my ego personal responsibility thing of everybody should be agreeable. Everybody should be happy all the time and kind all the time. And, you know, and I've just learned that that's not necessarily true with all of us. So understanding that in a relationship is super important of, because the tendency for me is to take things personally. So I have to kind of remember, oh, this person just loves competition and conflict and debate. They're not really attacking me personally. They just go through life that way.
Sure, sure. I think that Of the different traits, I think this is the one that is probably, or at least of the ones we've covered so far, has so many different relational implications. So being introverted and extroverted, while on its surface, it's like, oh, well, that has everything to do with relationships. Mm-hmm. But really that has to do with like whether and in what context we choose to participate in relationships. Mm-hmm. But this really has to do with when we are in relationships, how do we show up? Mm-hmm. What is the animating force that, you know, characterizes how we participate in these relationships? And I think that a lot of it has to do with, and I think coworkers is a really great way to think about this. You know, are we showing up in the space of our coworkers where we say like, we're all working together toward a common goal, but as we work toward that common goal, we're doing so with a lot of deference to one another, with a lot of respect toward one another, with a lot of kindness toward one another. We're not trying to step on each other's toes, or there's the, you know, and I think that on its surface, you would say like, okay, well, that sounds like a really positive, collaborative atmosphere, and it would be great if everybody was like that. And I think that in our, you know, corporate culture of the United States, I think that there is some leaning toward that, but invariably it feels like there's always one or two people who are probably more in that disagreeable space where they just say, you know what, like, I'm here to achieve results. Like, I'm not here to make friends. I don't want to be your buddy. I am going to do what it takes to make sure that we achieve whatever goal, you know, is necessary. When you were talking about, you know, hoping everybody's agreeable, you and I actually both worked in the same department, and we only overlapped for a small space, like one time. But one of the things that I always was amused by, because we worked at a church with a team of pastors, like a dozen pastors. And it was adorable to watch them have like a humble off sometimes. That's what I called it in my head, was a humble off, where they would like, who's going to hold the door for who? It's like, no, let me get the door. Yes. No, let me get the door. No, let
like
me get the door.
Yeah,
exactly. And and then like,
or Chip and Dale. That's who it is.
Yeah. And then, you know, figuring out like, well, who's going to take this? Well, I'll take this, and I'll you know, take this responsibility. And again, like, in those spaces, having somebody who's able to say, and there's actually a running joke in that department during one of the pastors' meetings one time. There was this question of like, hey, who can support this event? Who can do this? And I said out loud, I would, but I don't want to. And
that's
like,
awesome.
And that became like this kind of joke of, because it was so atypical for
it was,
how
right,
a lot
and
of people
so brave
up in
for
space.
You. What a great thing to model for pastors of like,
yeah,
you
but
can
it,
speak up.
But it isn't that's not an agreeable way of being, right? We wouldn't want to sort of give voice to this idea that like
that
we don't like, you know, I don't care that your lives are gonna be harder.
Yes.
I don't want to be doing that thing.
Yes.
And I think that speaks to, I think, one of the chief challenges of balancing this in a dyad is when you have a partner who is more agreeable and a partner who is less agreeable. The partner who is more agreeable, I mean, if you just think about it in terms of the word agreeable, is going to agree to more things, is going to be more focused on how different things are experienced and perceived, versus how the partner who is less agreeable, they're just gonna be like, I don't care, like that it doesn't matter to me how this affects other people. So one example that is existing in our lives right now is like family pictures, and I don't know, a lot of my family listens to this, so I hope this isn't like this big secret, but like, we're trying to organize family pictures, and it's also COVID and those types of things, and Lindsay is very inclined towards saying, well, you know, this is what your sister wants, and this is what your mom wants, and this is kind of how all of these people are focused on this. And I'm like, I don't care. What do we want? Like, what is going to make the most sense for us mm-hmm. in our space? And like, left to her own devices, Lindsay is the type of person who will be very accommodating towards other people yes. and what other people need. Whereas I am going to be much more focused on, you know, how do we set up clear boundaries that effectively, you know, advocate for that? And just like all of these other things, those tendencies really call us to be in conversation with one another where we can say, okay, in what ways am I being too harsh? Mm-hmm. Am I being too restrictive? Am I being too lackadaisical about what other people are thinking and feeling? Mm-hmm. And in what ways are you being, you know, too accommodating and too, you know, interested in how we can meet other people's needs?
Yeah, we have this happening right now in our house because it's Rob's birthday on Saturday. And I'm like, what do you want to do for your birthday? I don't know, whatever everybody mm-hmm. else wants to do. Like, it's your sure. birthday and I want to do what you want to do. So, you know, and we were laughing about it because on my birthday, which was a few weeks ago, I made the restaurant reservation. I was like, you know, because I didn't want to bother anybody else with planning mm-hmm. mine. So this is what agreeableness looks like. And so, you know, I very much like kind of took charge, but mm-hmm. wanted to do it so that nobody else was burdened with it. Rob is like, whatever, I'm good, I'm happy, I just want to be with you guys. Well, that's like too agreeable, right? Because it's the one day that you get to pick everything and we will do, it's all about you. But that's uncomfortable for him to have it all about. He'd rather serve the rest of us. So that's where, you know, too much agreeableness can turn into one day you wake up and you're like, I'm a doormat and everybody's been walking all over me. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, where we all have to kind of keep it in check of, you know, and that's where you mentioned resentment and boundaries. And I think that's so powerful. I remember Sherry Danner, who's a therapist we both worked with and now a life coach. And she taught me this line of, without boundaries, you will have resentment. Mm. And if you're having resentment, it was because you didn't have boundaries. Mm. And that has been so true and mm-hmm. throughout my life and still. And I have to constantly keep that in check, that if I say yes to everything, mm-hmm. I end up resentful and mad at the person that just asked me to do something, you know, thinking I would love it. And so I have to keep that in check of, am I being too agreeable? Because that's a recipe for disaster. I work with some people that kind of feel like, how did I become such a doormat for other mm-hmm. people in my lives? How did I allow this to happen, that I am the one that's getting walked over and never has a voice and mm-hmm. is completely disrespected? Yeah. And so it's kind of this like little, you know, cumulative little things add up to finally one day you realize, oh, my agreeableness has hurt me in a mm-hmm. way. And yeah. so I think that's the downside of it.
Sure, sure. And I think that one of the things that I think is, I think it's easier to identify the ways in which boundaries are about not saying yes when we should say no. Mm-hmm. But there's also a passivity in agreeableness that I think we could pay attention to, where we say it's when we want something to happen, mm-hmm. but we don't know. We don't have kind of the inner strength to be disruptive enough for that to happen.
That's right.
Exactly. And I see that in relationships a lot, where one partner is like, hey, I want the relationship to look like this. I want the patterns to be like this. Like, and in the context of my office, they can maybe feel enough support to articulate that. But outside of a space where they have that additional support, it is really hard to say, hey, you know, I want to do this more often. I want to communicate more like this. I want these to be the features that define our relationship. But it can be hard to name that. And because they don't want to rock the boat and disrupt some of that status quo, they sort of allow. And so resentment, again, flows. But it's that different kind of boundary. You know,
exactly.
It's the instead of being able to say, like, hey, I don't want you to do this. It's more of like, that's one kind of boundary that you can set. But the other one is like saying, like, no, like, respecting me looks like honoring the things that are important to me as
exactly.
well.
Exactly.
So I think that there's both of those.
Yeah.
I think that in this season and the way that this shows up in relationships, one of the ways that I think we can grow our agreeableness, I'm thinking about when after the Tuesday night debates, I I had some thoughts. Now, because I am not somebody who is generally prone toward agreeableness, and I'm more on the challenge and disrupt kind of scale for agreeableness, I basically said to Lindsay, okay, here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I'm going to say. And you can just kind of see her eyes go kind of like deer in the headlights, like, oh, like, maybe don't post that. You know, and then I ended, and I did, like, I feel like I knew that on my own, there was a chance that I was going to post something that was going to be too contentious to be received well, too disruptive to be actually valuable in terms of adding to the discourse around how those debates went. And so her being more agreeable, now she is agreeable enough where she might not want to stir the pot at all. She might want to just say, okay, I don't want to upset anybody, so I'm not going to say anything. So what I ended up doing and what I wrote, we didn't have a lot of direct engagement with this post, but I was thinking like, okay, what do I want to say and what would Lindsay be okay with me saying?
Yeah, that's
kind of how I thought about it.
It's a good filter.
And so, and then we processed it afterward and she was like, yeah, like I felt like it wasn't too, you know, it wasn't too antagonistic. You know, I left some things out and some words out that I probably would have otherwise included. And, you know, maybe of the, you know, a few hundred people that saw it, one or two people said, okay, maybe there's something there that they can take away from and, you know, we can actually shape that influence a little bit. Whereas if I had just posted it on my own, nobody's minds would have been changed because it was too antagonistic. So I think as we think about what it means to engage in a moment like this, where there is so much capacity for either just, you know, being totally cowed in the face of how disruptive everything is or being really, really aggressive and... Is agitative a word? Like
it is
wanting
now.
To, oh, sure. It is now. Sure. you know, like, because again, that's where the poles of this personality trait exist. And if our partners can encourage us to find a middle space where we say like, how can we, and if you have two agreeable partners, you know, that it reminds me of, the vultures at the end of the Jungle Book, the one from the 60s, where it's like, I don't know, what do you want to do?
Yes,
I don't know, what do you want to do?
I know, I just saw this meme that reminded me of Chip and Dale. They're the Disney characters that are always like, no, after you. No, I insist, you go first. Like your pastor story. And there was a meme that was circulating Wednesday that said if women were debating and it was the dialogue of, oh, sorry, I interrupted you. No, what were you saying? You go ahead. I'll be quiet. You know, it was all of this graciousness. And I thought, so that was, I laughed at first when I saw it and I was like, yes, that's true. Women wouldn't have been probably interrupting and stealing the mic. Maybe some women. But then I thought, to your point, there's a medium there, though, too, because women are learning to use their voices. And sometimes too much politeness is kind of a systemic way to shut each other down. And that's not what we need to go for either. But there was a civility that would have been nice to see
that
on
word,
Tuesday
that
night.
Word civility feels like the space in the middle, because civility doesn't mean acquiescence. It doesn't mean doormat. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be so shaped by your needs as a person and your comfort that I'm just not going to speak.
Right.
And instead I'm going, but I'm not also going to be somebody that is, you know, so focused on attacking, so focused on, you know, articulating my own agenda that I don't care how it affects you.
Exactly.
And that kind of dynamic, I think, is what would be really, really great in, I think, a lot of political spaces. It's harder and harder to find, I think, because it feels like the only things that cut through the noise are the most disruptive things, the things that are way on the non-agreeable end of the agreeableness spectrum. So I think it's harder to find those spaces, especially when we're talking about the ways that we engage socially. I think that the when we do our best to sort of live into those spaces, I can't remember where and how this I posted this. It was late last week or early this week, but I made a post that had some, you know, political thoughts in it, and I had a family member who. Was commenting, and that family member disagreed with me politically, and I immediately knew that it's like I don't know if in the space of this public forum, like I'm not gonna be able to do it. Like I said, like I am not gonna be able to be civil. I'm not going to be able to rise to the level of civility that is necessary for this to be productive. So what I actually did was a friend of mine had liked the post. And so I texted him and I was like, hey, I want to, it's important to me that these points are responded to, but I don't think that they need to be responded to by me. Mm. And you are a very gracious person.
Good.
Can you respond to that?
Smart.
And then, and Lindsay was like, man, I really like what he said about that. And I'm like, good. Like, it's like, I think that it was like if Lindsay approves it, I think that it communicates the level of like affirmation and civility that we really need. And it would be great if we would allow our own egos to rest long enough. And I'm not trying to like lift that up as like me and my ego are so chill and relaxed. I have a podcast where I literally just like talk for, you know, extended periods of time. But I do think that like that is the type of engagement that it will take for these, you know, social spaces to be more civil is for us to say, okay, well, what if this isn't about me? Mm-hmm. You know, even for just the space of a moment, exactly. What if this wasn't about me?
Well, I think civility is hardest when we are in fear and anger, right? We know that. And so I think as a nation, we have to see that we have a collective case of fear and anger right now, exponentially, I think, from so many different directions of unrest in our personal lives, our nation. And so if we are aware that we are all operating at higher levels of fear than we ever have before, maybe as a nation, as far as in our lifetime and the perfect storm of things all converging right now on top of us, then we have to understand that civility is that much harder to do. And so what I like about how you handled Facebook was we have to be super intentional to think, okay, I am easily triggered and defensive right now because we're all living in a state of high fear.
Right.
It's that pause. It's like a holy pause. In the Psalms, it's the word Selah, S-E-L-A-H. You see that word and it's like a holy pause. Like that was a big emotion. Let's just sit for a second. Let's pause before we decide what our next steps are. And so, and I'm teaching on the Psalms right now, so I'm super tuned into it, but it shows up like I think 74 times in the Psalms. And it always, it's just a Hebrew word off to the side that is a take a breath, take a moment. And I think that that's what you model, that we all have to be super intentional about and just know we're operating as fragile beings right now. And so if we want to be kind and show grace and forgive and have civil conversations, then it's more required than ever that we are aware of the pause we need to take before we react.
Right. And I think that we can say that that goes in both directions, because I think that that fear can lead to to action that is too hasty or inaction, you know, and it's possible that both of those are inappropriate based on what we're actually confronted with. And so, I think if there's a broader lesson that we want to draw from this, but a lot of these is that in the context of a relationship, like pay attention to your inclinations. When you're confronted with a situation, what feels like the default response? And so much of the work around mindfulness and what we try to guide people toward is paying attention to the things that we do like on autopilot, where it's like, okay, my family is presenting me with a bunch of needs. Now my autopilot response is accommodate those needs like in their totality without paying attention to what I'm experiencing. Okay. How much is that allowing you to be your best self or the best self that is flowing in the context of your family? And again, if it's the opposite and it's like now my autopilot response is just like, screw everybody else, what do I want? And often when connecting with your partner, you can find the space in the middle that says, okay, we're going to pay attention to what we need, but also what our family needs, because we value our family and we value those relationships. And so we can have a more nuanced conversation. And you could do that on your own too, you know, in paying attention to that autopilot response. But it does take the pause, right? It does, you know, I can't remember how and where I think it was in a parenting class that I taught this, where it was like, before you respond to your kids, like count to 30.
Yeah.
And not just like as, you know, in the sort of prototypical, like de-escalate your anger kind of thing, but that's going to give you space to reevaluate what your sort of automatic response is versus what your best self response is. And I think on this spectrum in particular of agreeableness to non-agreeableness, that could be really valuable.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's such a great tip for all relationships is to slow down the reaction time for all of us. And I think that, you know, maybe that's the great learning that's unfolding from all of this mess, is that, you know, we are becoming better people, I hope. I don't know. I'm beginning to wonder if, you know, I think about all of the young people that had the homework assignment to watch the presidential debate, right? And what are these young people watching, and what are they learning? Because we're not seeing people in front of us that are, you know, leaders that are, I don't know, presidential, I guess is the word that's coming to mind. That's cliche, but like a leader that we could assume is operating from a place of what's best for our country: intelligence, civility, respect for human life or other human beings. You know, we're not seeing a lot of that modeled right now. And so as adults, we kind of know, okay, these are some strong characters, and we're watching, you know, this drama unfold. But for children watching these behaviors, I do wonder. My kids and I watched the debate for a bit together, and they were disgusted. They were like, they're just yelling at each other. We're not, they're not even answering questions or getting to what they're going to do as president. And, you know, so at least I guess they can filter the lack of civility. They're seeing that that doesn't accomplish anything. But there is also, there are people out there that, that feel like this is a permission slip to be rude and disagreeable and combative and interrupt. And, you know, this kind of social decorum that we've all learned, back to your political correctness, the way we started the episode, circling back to that of, you know, we are seeing less and less of that in a sense. And I guess it's up to all of us listening to this, and you and I, to be contributors of that and try to model against the loud voices.
And that to me feels like the primary lesson I think that we draw is we can decide what we want to take away and take away from spaces like that, how we want to participate in spaces like that. And with all things, we just, I think that what we're called to do is to do things with intentionality and with some measure of critical thinking. In your response to, you know, how are people receiving the debates? Like, my hope is, like your kids are, they're looking at that and saying like, okay, let's not be that, you know, let's be anything but that, you know, or at least being able to observe and like that be the primary lesson. But at an individual level, I think so much of what, we are called to be is, are people that are always sort of working toward the middle, working toward a space of not any particular extreme in one way or the other. That's not to say that we don't take radical stands and do the things that are necessary in the face of really extreme injustice. But I do think that the most extreme response is rarely the one that is going to allow for the most transformation. You know, it is the, you know, the long painstaking work of, you know, showing up in spaces where people will actually hear you and receive you. You know, if you think about like the largest churches or the people or the most popular musicians, even, you know, they're like, they're places where there's not a whole lot of challenging going on. Mostly it is a message that is easily received, and that there's a lot of transformative power in that. There's there's a platform that exists when you're able to say, hey, let's find this middle space between, we're going to let everybody walk all over us, and we are going to be the fire and brimstone. This is the way that the world needs to look. We should probably stop before we get onto different soapboxes that are going to get us in trouble. So, yeah, that will be it for today. I'm James, and you can find information about my practice at talkingwithjames.com.
And I'm Ginger Rathus, and you can find me at compassionfix.com.
We both got a couple of cool projects going on, all that stuff you can find on our website. We'll promote it more promotingly at another,
but we'll be agreeable this time.
we'll be more agreeable. So I think that's all. We'll be back next week. So part four, we'll kind of, we're running out of big five to talk about, because this is the third one, but next week we'll talk about either neuroticism, or did we do openness yet?
No, openness, we haven't done openness. We have ONN.
Yeah, so that's openness to change, and then neuroticism, which is the most fraught one, the most problematic one, I think. So we'll look forward to covering those. Anything else you got, Ginger?
Nope. Until then, Be well.